these Democrats happen to be black, they get a second district. If they were all white, we all agree they wouldn't get a second district.
The Supreme Court hears a Louisiana case with major national implications for voting rights.
It's Wednesday, October 15th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Melissa Nadworny. This hour, what are the stakes of calling an armed conflict a genocide?
The term refers to intentionally destroying a group of people, and it keeps coming up in the context of the war in Gaza.
If you take that group, if you destroy its museums, its archives, its schools, you make it impossible for the group to reconstitute itself.
Plus, a new study on earthworms may have figured out how animals use Earth's magnetic fields to get around.
They need to navigate somehow, and the magnetic sense is the perfect thing if you navigate underground.
That's ahead. First the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A federal court says President Trump has to stop firing workers during the government shutdown. U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston in San Francisco issued the ruling after federal agencies started laying off workers last week. Trump has said he's targeting what he calls Democrat agencies. Democrats say they're not intimidated by Trump, blaming them for the layoffs. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says Democrats are holding firm on their demands for Congress to extend health care subsidies.
Neither Trump nor congressional Republicans are even trying to solve the health care crisis. And that is just a horror for the American people.
Meanwhile, Republicans are confident in their strategy to not negotiate with Democrats on health care until the government is reopened. Here's Senate Majority Leader John Thune.
I think the American people are wondering when the Senate Democrats are going to end their temper tantrum and vote to reopen the government.
A bill to temporarily fund the government again failed in the Senate today. Government workers are feeling the effects of the shutdown as it stretches into week three. Gabriella Paul at member station WUSF spoke with a federal worker who says it's affecting her finances and mental health.
Tiara Carter answers the phones for the Social Security Administration in Tampa. She's working without pay until the shutdown ends.
We're stressing about the fight that's going on in the White House. We're also stressing out about how we're going to handle our financial situations at home.
Last week, the Trump administration began mass layoffs across several federal agencies. Carter says her department is spared for now.
To be completely honest, I feel ashamed to be an American citizen right now. I mean, who does this to their own essential workers?
Every day the shutdown drags on, Carter says the agency's backlog of service requests grows. For NPR News, I'm Gabriella Paul in Tampa.
The Supreme Court's conservative majority appears open to prohibiting race from being used when creating congressional districts. NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports such a ruling would roll back the landmark Voting Rights Act and give Republicans an advantage in Congress.
For decades, the Voting Rights Act has required certain places where voting is racially polarized to draw districts where racial minority voters have a realistic opportunity of electing their preferred candidates. And during oral arguments over their constitutionality, one of the high court's liberal justices, Elena Kagan, asked the Legal Defense Fund's Janae Nelson about the possibility of ending those requirements.
What would the results on the ground be?
I think the results would be pretty catastrophic. If we take Louisiana as one example, every congressional member who is black was elected from a VRA opportunity district.
Depending on when the Supreme Court rules, it could allow Republicans to redraw up to 19 more House districts in their favor before next year's election. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Most U.S. stocks rose following another up and down day on Wall Street. This is NPR News from Washington. Syria's interim leader held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. That's even though President Ahmad al-Shara led the rebel offensive last year that ousted former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who had Moscow's support. Russia gave asylum to Assad after he fled the country, but Russia is trying to establish ties with Syria's new leadership and secure a military foothold there. A new report from Consumer Reports on protein powders finds many best-selling products contain traces of lead and other heavy metals. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the organization is calling for stricter regulation from the Food and Drug Administration.
Consumer Reports analyzed 23 protein powders and shakes and found about 70% contained levels of lead that the group says is concerning. The FDA sets a threshold for lead that is acceptable in baby food, but the group is asking the FDA to establish limits on lead in protein powders. Children and pregnant people are most vulnerable to potential harms, and experts say one way to minimize exposure is not to consume too much of any one product. Lead levels in plant-based products were about 9 times the amount found in dairy-based products. One explanation is that lead has accumulated in the environment and is often detected in trace amounts in crops including rice and peas, which are used to make protein powders. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
LeBron James, Chris Paul, and Kyle Lowry are making history as they enter their 20th NBA seasons or more. It's the first time the league has had three players in the 20-season club simultaneously. James will soon become the first pro basketballer to play 23 seasons. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks for listening to People Powered, KAXE, and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. If you are at least 70 and a half years old, supporting KAXE's future is easy. You can ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to benefit KAXE. If you have questions, you can call Chris 218-326-1234. We have a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, the Supreme Court seemed headed for another ruling that undercuts the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Now, that law was repeatedly strengthened by Congress. It was upheld by the Supreme Court in the decades after it was enacted. But the current conservative court has been largely hostile to it, as NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Once considered the jewel in the crown of the civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act has been largely dismembered since 2013 by the increasingly conservative Supreme Court. The major exception was a decision just 2 years ago that upheld the section of the law aimed at ensuring that minority voters are not shut out of the process of drawing new congressional district lines. But today, Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote the court's decision 2 years ago, downplayed the importance of that ruling, suggesting that he didn't see his decision as controlling the outcome in today's case. At issue was a redistricting map drawn by the Louisiana legislature after the decennial census. After years of litigation, the state, with a 30% black population, agreed to draw a second majority black district. Normally, that would have been the end of the case, but a self-described group of non-African American voters intervened at that point to object to the legislature's redistricting. Supporting them in the Supreme Court today, Trump administration Deputy Solicitor General Hashim Mupan contended that the black voters should not have gotten a second majority minority district.
If they were all white, we all agree they wouldn't get a second district.
The court's liberal justices all pointed out that the federal law is based on the effects of redistricting in a state like Louisiana, where, as they noted, voters are so racially polarized that even white Democrats, for the most part, don't vote for black candidates. But the court's conservatives seem to have a different view. Justice Alito, for instance, said that seeking a partisan advantage is not the same thing as seeking a racial advantage. That's not so, replied lawyer Janae Nelson of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. If race is used to gain partisan advantage, she maintained, that is unconstitutional.
The extreme racially polarized voting that we have in the state of Louisiana cannot be explained away by party. We're talking about racially polarized voting that is above 84%.
Meaning essentially that all but 16% of white voters do not vote for black candidates. Justice Kavanaugh, who cast the decisive fifth vote in a similar case from Alabama 2 years ago, today reiterated his view that there should be an end point to racial remedies like this one.
This court's cases, in a variety of contexts, have said that race-based remedies are permissible for a period of time, but that they should not be indefinite.
But Nelson replied that while many provisions of the voting rights law did have time limits, Congress deliberately did not put a limit on this provision of the law. What's more, she said, the non-discrimination element of the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which gave Congress the power to enforce the right to vote, also has no time limit. Justice Kagan asked Nelson what the results would be if the court were to nullify or otherwise limit the redistricting provision of the federal law. I think it would be pretty catastrophic, said Nelson, noting that the African-American House members elected across the South had won their seats because of the federal law that forced creation of majority-minority districts. Justice Gorsuch followed up.
So do they have the breathing room to intentionally discriminate on the basis of race?
No, replied Nelson, adding that the only breathing room here is to ensure that districts drawn to dilute the black vote are eliminated. Countering that argument today was Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga.
The avowed purpose of drawing a majority black district is to diminish the voting strength of some racial groups and augment the voting strength of others.
But Justice Sotomayor noted that the last time Aguinaga had been before the court in this very case last term, he had defended the creation of the new majority black district. Are you walking that back? She asked. Aguinaga did not fully answer the question. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
A fragile ceasefire is holding so far in Gaza, yet the Palestinian territory is already facing urgent questions about its future. Who's going to govern Gaza, provide security, and oversee the monumental job of reconstruction? To see where this is headed, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Alyssa.
So, a very basic question. Who is actually in charge of Gaza right now?
Well, at this moment, no one can legitimately claim to be in charge. The ceasefire agreement says Hamas will no longer govern Gaza. And in practice, the Hamas leadership inside the territory was decimated by 2 years of war. It's hard to say who are the top officials there anymore. So right now, you essentially have 2 million people in Gaza, largely on their own, trying to meet their daily needs of food and shelter. So I spoke about this in The Road Ahead with Mukamar Abu Sada. He's a political science professor from Gaza, though he's been living in Cairo.
The easy part has been done. The most complicated issues will be in the second stage of this Trump proposal, meaning the governance of Gaza, the militarization of Gaza, and also rebuilding and reconstruction of Gaza.
So who is going to fill this vacuum if no one's in control?
Well, the ceasefire calls for a committee of Palestinian technocrats to run Gaza on an interim basis. Egypt's foreign minister says there is now a list of 15 people, and he says the names have been approved by Hamas and Israel. However, the names haven't been announced, and it's not clear when they'll take over or how much authority they'll have to take care of things like health care, education, water, electricity, coordination with aid groups. And Alyssa, as you know, the needs are staggering, and this committee certainly won't have many resources to work with.
Would they be in charge of Gaza's security?
So it seems they'll likely play a role, though we really don't have any clarity. Right now, the Hamas civilian police, armed with guns, have returned to the streets. And these Hamas policemen have been in deadly shootouts already with some Palestinian clans, which are essentially armed gangs. So the security situation is very volatile. Now, Egypt says it's training about 5,000 new Palestinian policemen for Gaza. This training has been taking place in recent weeks in Egypt. It's not clear when these new policemen might come to Gaza and if Hamas will accept this new authority. The ceasefire does call for Hamas to disarm, and we heard President Trump say yesterday, quote, if they don't disarm, we will disarm them, and it will happen quickly and perhaps violently. But realistically, the U.S. is not going to send troops into Gaza, and Israel couldn't fully disarm Hamas in 2 years of war. So Hamas will have to do this voluntarily, or it probably won't happen.
Right. Well, finally, reconstruction in Gaza is going to be a massive undertaking. I mean, what are we hearing at this point?
Well, we're hearing some huge numbers about the cost of rebuilding. The UN has put the figure of $70 billion out there. And job one would just be clearing the destroyed buildings, which have been reduced to mounds of rubble. Now, President Trump says he expects wealthy Arab states to provide the money. He's probably talking about Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar. These countries have helped rebuild Gaza in the past, but this time they haven't publicly committed money so far, and they'll want to see Gaza become a little more stable before they're likely to start pouring money in.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you so much, Greg.
Sure thing, Alyssa.
That was NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv.
To the surprise of absolutely no one, Taylor Swift's new album, The Life of a Showgirl, is a commercial hit. But when you look closer at the sales numbers, there is one surprising aspect to its success. NPR's Hazel Sills reports.
This week, Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl reaches number one on the Billboard Albums Chart, and all of its songs top the Billboard Hot 100, including The Fate of Ophelia. Overall, it sold a little over 4 million equivalent album units. That's the combo of sales and streaming that Billboard uses to rank albums each week. But the most surprising takeaway from Showgirl's early numbers? How many of those sales were good old-fashioned vinyl records? The Life of a Showgirl sold a little over 1.3 million copies of vinyl in its first week. But how massive really is that amount? Let's do some math. This year so far, total vinyl sales in the U.S. are at 30 million units. That means sales for The Life of a Showgirl account for nearly 4.5% of that, and that's just for the first week. To put that into perspective, the massive Minneapolis record store Electric Fetus currently stocks 32,000 vinyl albums. To meet Swift's first week sales numbers, someone would have to walk into that store, buy all of the vinyl, come back after they've restocked that amount, buy it all up again, and repeat the process 42 times in total. If time is a better metric for you, consider it takes 30 seconds to press an individual copy of a vinyl album. In the 11,117 hours it took to physically produce all of those Showgirl copies, you could fly direct from New York to Tokyo about 790 times. And let's say, just for a thought experiment, that each of those copies of The Life of a Showgirl went for $29.99. the current price for the vinyl on Swift's own web store. At that price, Swift made over 40 million in vinyl sales. With that kind of money, she could buy over 6.6 million Big Macs, priced at $6.01 each, or 77 Rolls-Royce Phantom cars at a base price of $517,750. Whatever suits the life of a showgirl better. Hazel Sills, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology, John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this state. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Slight chance of showers tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s, and tomorrow showers are likely, possible thunderstorms, highs 57 to 65.
On today's date, October 15th, in the years 2001, 2015, and again in 2017, I have notes indicating that the big tooth aspen reached their last peak of color. And in the aggregate, it turns out that the big tooth aspen tend to reach their peak of color right about the middle of October. And when they have reached their peak of color, in some years, in years where you've had a nice warm summer with lots of moisture and enough sunlight, you get a real excess of sugars in the plant. And in those years, the big tooth aspen leaves can become almost a fluorescent orange. Think of that deer hunter's jacket color orange. And some years, the big-tooth aspen way up at the tops of the trees just shine with a bright, bright orange. I can recall one day walking in the woods and thinking that the sun was shining on the top of this one big-tooth aspen. But it wasn't a sunny day. It was a cloudy day, and it was just that bright, bright orange color that stood out so vibrantly against that gray sky and really, really caught the eye. So as we move into the middle of October, keep an eye on the big-tooth aspens. They can put on quite a show when the weather's just right.
NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. So what are the stakes of calling an armed conflict a genocide? Even as a ceasefire agreement takes hold, the term continues to come up in relation to the war in Gaza. Last month, a UN commission released a report accusing Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Leah Donnella of NPR's Code Switch podcast has spent some time dissecting what this word means and why it matters. She's here to help us break it down. Hi, Leah.
Hi, Alpha.
Okay, so first, we do have to note that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as other representatives of the Israeli government, do strongly deny any charges of genocide. But can we just talk about what the term genocide actually means?
It's important to understand that the term genocide has a very specific legal definition. It refers to intentionally destroying a group of people in whole or in part. And that intent is what makes the term different from a crime against humanity or mass killing or other types of crimes. Committing genocide doesn't just have to involve killing members of a group. There are lots of elements that can lead to that outcome. Here's Omer Bartov, a genocide scholar at Brown University.
If you take that group, if you destroy its museums, its archives, its universities, its schools, its mosques, what you're doing, you make it impossible for the group, even if it can stay where it lived, to reconstitute itself.
So it's not just about bloodshed, but also about destroying an identity.
Obliterating a collective memory. Well, you know, going back to that UN Commission report that we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, what happens when countries or international bodies deem a situation a genocide?
So the international community is obligated to intervene when something is deemed a genocide. That was something that countries agreed on in 1948 when they signed a treaty called the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Today, more than 150 countries have signed on to that treaty, and both the U.S. and Israel are signatories. Now, that UN Commission report has called on the rest of the world to intervene, but the U.S. State Department has denounced the report and rejected its findings. I spoke with Mohammed El-Kurd, who's a Palestinian author and has written a lot about how the world perceives violence against Palestinians. He talked about his frustration at how that violence often goes unchecked.
The convention of genocide was not created to help historians feel confident about their assessments long after genocide has ceased. It was created to compel people to act in the moment to stop it.
But to be clear, it's not only the UN Commission making calls on this front, right?
Right. So individual countries can make allegations of genocide. South Africa and about two dozen other signatories, for example, have brought a case against Israel to the International Court of Justice. And then many people and groups around the world have been calling on the United States specifically to put pressure on Israel or stop arming Israel as a way of intervening.
But Leah, has that ever happened? Like, has a country like the U.S. or some international body ever actually intervened during a genocide while it is happening and made a difference?
So in the past, by the time something is being prosecuted by the International Court of Justice, mm-hmm. or even just referred to as genocide by the most powerful countries in the world, it has been years after the killing has ended. Mm. And that's one of the biggest criticisms around what's happening in Gaza right now.
Yeah. Look, I get that language matters, but I can also imagine that for some people out there, the violence, the killing, all of that just needs to stop, whether or not it's formally deemed a genocide or not, because something terrible is happening. Is that what you're hearing as well during this whole debate on whether or not what's happening in Gaza is a genocide?
You know, the thing I've actually heard from a lot of people is that language has meaning. Mohammed El-Kurd, who you heard from earlier, mm-hmm. says that what many of these conversations about language miss is that behind the words, there is a human toll that all of this violence has on real people.
I am talking about lovers and friends and families who have been separated from each other. I think about the people who have died without getting the opportunity to say sorry to one another or to say to each other that I love you or to have a food that they wanted to eat. You know, we're talking about our people and our neighbors and our friends.
So in thinking about big official legal definitions, it can be easy to gloss over the fact that we are discussing real violence that is happening to real people.
Indeed. That is Leah Donnella of NPR's Code Switch podcast. Thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Thank you.
And for more reporting, analysis, and different views on the conflict, go to npr.org/Mideast Updates.
Scientists have known for decades that some animals use the Earth's magnetic field to help them navigate, kind of like an internal GPS. How they do it, though, remains unclear. NPR's Nate Rott reports on a new study which suggests earthworms may help provide an answer.
For the better part of a decade, behavioral ecologist Yanni Vortman's research into magnetoreception, which we'll talk more about in a minute, focused on birds. He recently switched to earthworms because, well, I'll let him tell you.
I got to earthworms because I was kind of frustrated with birds, actually.
Birds were doing you dirty or what?
Birds are like a border collie. You try to do an experiment with them and they jump towards the light and a lot of things really interfere with them. I don't know if you have a dog.
I do have a dog.
Then you know that you can try to train him to something, but then if he hears the noise, he's going the other direction. And birds are like flying dogs.
Earthworms are less distractible. They don't have eyes or ears. And when you're trying to determine how a species chooses where to go and what sense they're using to make that decision, it's easier when there are fewer inputs. So with worms,
the intuition of most biologists is that earthworms move randomly. They don't really navigate.
But Vortman, who works at Tel Hai Academic College in northern Israel, says when you consider that to move, earthworms have to literally eat dirt, expending a lot of energy.
Then, of course, they don't move randomly, and they need to navigate somehow, and the magnetic sense is the perfect thing if you navigate underground.
The magnetic sense, magnetoreception, if we want to be fancy, is an animal's ability to detect the Earth's magnetic field. Scientists have found that all sorts of animals, not humans, but sea turtles, sharks, salamanders, and birds, just to name a few, have this internal compass, this sixth sense.
But somehow, amazingly, it's the only sense that we don't know where is the sensor.
In other words, we know eyes are for seeing, ears for hearing. So what are they using to detect magnetic fields? Scientists have many theories. Maybe it's biochemical reactions detecting magnetism. Maybe it's electroreceptors. It's all very heady. Vortman's current hypothesis for worms is a symbiotic magnetic bacteria, which he says is for another paper and another discussion. But he says the paper he just published in the journal Biology Letters showing that worms have this magnetic sense too could really help scientists answer the broader question.
Many things that we cannot do with birds or sea turtles, we can do with earthworms.
For example, if you want to sample 40 sea turtles to understand how they're navigating, it's difficult and expensive.
If you want to sample 40 earthworms, I don't know, you can go to the next fishing store, right?
They're ubiquitous, cheap, and as we now know, a heck of a lot easier to work with than birds. Nate Rott, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
it's 4:29. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. We also thank ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. Chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s. Showers likely tomorrow, again, possible thunderstorms. Highs 57 to 65, winds from the southeast 10 to 15. Looking ahead to Friday, slight chance of showers, highs in the 60s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The remnants of Typhoon Halong over the weekend have left at least one woman dead and more than 1,000 people displaced in western Alaska. The disaster happened right before the start of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention and the Elders and Youth Conference. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Nidem reports that the storm is shaping the tone of this year's events.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention always focuses on issues most pertinent to local indigenous communities. And this year, a catastrophic storm that battered predominantly Alaska Native villages is already the center of the conversations. Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke at the beginning of the Elders and Youth Conference, the traditional prologue to the main AFN event.
As we gather for this sharing and this collective convening, let us keep in mind those that are in harm's way and those who are out there to be with them and to help them.
Communities and rescue groups are still looking for missing people and assessing the damage from the storm. Meanwhile, AFN and other local Indigenous organizations are looking for ways to help. AFN is one of 12 mostly Indigenous organizations that formed the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund to provide assistance to villages. On Thursday, AFN plans to hold a blanket dance fundraiser for the disaster. Roy Glowing is the president of the First Alaskans Institute that hosts the Elders and Youth Conference. On Sunday, he spoke about the destruction from the storm.
It's easy to feel distant, but I ask you to lean in, because while the storm may be hundreds of miles away, the people affected are our neighbors, our friends, and our family.
Marilyn Atla is a healer from the interior who participated in the Elders and Youth Conference. She invited attendees, especially young people, to talk about what they feel and consider visiting a healing station.
You have to make up your own mind to be resilient. Any type of loss that you're going to go through in your life, any type of happening, problem, you have to make up your own mind to overcome it.
The Elders and Youth Conference is running at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage through Wednesday. AFN is scheduled there from Thursday to Saturday. With reporting help from Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
Meanwhile, community groups and businesses across the state are coordinating storm relief efforts for the devastated communities. The Alaska Community Foundation has partnered with local and regional organizations to create the Western Alaska Disaster Relief Fund. The foundation's Ashley Ellingson says they're distributing the funds to communities hit hardest.
It's geared towards immediate support and then long-term resilience. And the thing that's unique about this fund is that we have partnered with local and regional organizations to make sure that the money goes to those to the areas that it's needed most.
The fund is a partnership with the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Association of Village Council Presidents, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and a number of other groups serving Alaskans in the region. As of Tuesday afternoon, the fund had raised more than $300,000 from donors. Jenny Ragland, chair of Alaska Voluntary Organizations Active in Disaster, says cash donations are a better option than goods, since storing and transporting items can present challenges of their own.
While it may seem impersonal, cash really is the best opportunity to help meet those immediate needs that are coming our way. It provides flexibility for us to purchase exactly what's needed to procure those items quickly and to get them into the hands of disaster survivors.
More information about the effort is online at alaskacf.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by AARP, whose Family Caregiver Resource Guide is available to caregivers by calling 877-333-5885 or at aarp.org/caregiver resources.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Nadworny.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For now, the Trump administration has been ordered to halt its layoffs of federal workers during the government shutdown. A federal judge in California today sided with two labor unions and granted a temporary restraining order against the administration, which has sent layoff notices to more than 4,000 federal employees. President Trump has called these layoffs financially necessary, though he has also often spoken about cutting, quote, Democrat programs. The unions contend that the Trump administration was using federal employees as political pawns. Well, I want to bring in Lee Saunders. He is the president of one of those unions, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Lee Saunders, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
I am going to guess that you were happy with this judge's decision today. What's your reaction?
Well, we are extremely happy with NAFSCME and AFGE, the two unions that filed this complaint. It really affirms that these threatened mass firings are illegal and blocks layoff notices from going out. And that's what the intent of the filing was. You know, I mean, look at what federal workers do every single day and the suffering that's taken place. They've already faced enough uncertainty from administration's relentless attacks on them. They are not being paid, or if they're working, they aren't being paid, or some have actually been sent home. So they're suffering right now.
I want to put a little bit of
it's unnecessary.
Forgive my jumping in. Let me put a human face on this. The federal employees who had received layoff notices already in these days since the shutdown began, the ones that are represented by your union, who are they? Where do they work in the government? Which agencies?
Well, they work all over the government. They work in the Department of Agriculture. They work in HHS. They work in the major facilities and major departments of the federal government, providing essential public services to the citizens of this country. And right now they have a reprieve because we were able to block this and continue to provide these essential public services to the citizens who rely upon this in our country.
So what kind of guidance are you giving them? I mean, this is a temporary restraining order, a temporary reprieve. What happens now? What's your understanding?
Well, we are telling them that they can continue to work, that they cannot be blocked by the administration. They cannot be laid off based upon this order. We know that we're going to have to continue this fight every single day. We know the intent of this administration is to hurt federal workers and to destroy public services across this country. And we're going to do everything possible not to let that happen.
Just to be clear, who is impacted by this ruling today? This does not affect non-union federal employees, right?
This affects the employees that are covered by the two unions represented, AFGE and AFGE and AFSCME.
So looking ahead and where this may go, we expect that the Trump administration will challenge this ruling. They did so in a related case earlier this year, the same judge, in fact, presiding. The Supreme Court waded into that. They allowed President Trump to move forward. If this case also ends up in front of the Supreme Court, would you expect the justices to rule any differently?
I don't even want to say what they will do, although there is a track record there that they could continue to harm federal workers. But what we're going to do is we're going to file a preliminary injunction, which simply means in order to ensure that these mass firings stay blocked. If it goes to the Supreme Court, then that's another ball game. But we're going to continue to keep fighting, regardless of what the Supreme Court does, as far as making sure that these workers are made whole, that they continue to provide public services to the citizens of this country. And that's the important piece that we cannot forget, that we've got to continue to push for and support these workers who are being treated unfairly, but also providing those services that Americans rely upon.
I guess, you know, big picture, the Trump administration is attempting to shrink the federal workforce. Administrations do that. They have the right to do that. Is there something specifically wrong with using layoffs to do so, if the effort is to change the federal workforce?
No, that is their choice, but the way that they're doing this and the way that they're doing it is wrong. It's completely, completely wrong. And the courts are siding with us. The court in California sided with us. They cannot do this. They don't have the ability to do this. That's the challenge. And that's why we filed the case. The two unions filed the case. What's going to happen next is up to them. We expect that they're going to continue, the administration, to harm federal workers, to reduce public services and impact on every single American across this country, and we're going to continue to fight it.
Lee Saunders, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Mr. Saunders, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
The federal government shutdown has affected tours of the National Memorial to the 168 victims of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. These tours are usually led by park rangers, who are now furloughed. But volunteers who were directly affected by the bombing have stepped in as temporary tour guides. Abigail Sikowski with member station KOSU tagged along.
A group of about 25 people gather around Susan Winchester at the Oklahoma City National Memorial.
I think we're going to go from here over to the wall.
She points to the 168 chairs set up in 9 rows across the grassy lawn, each row representing one floor of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building bombed in 1995, the deadliest homegrown terror attack in U.S. history.
The chairs are each individually created, and they have the name of a person lost on each one. Every single chair is a little bit different because they were handmade.
With the rangers furloughed, family members and even survivors are stepping in to give these tours. Winchester lost her sister, Margaret Clark, in the bombing. That's why she wanted to make sure they continue during the shutdown.
It's a story we really want to put in front of everyone each and every day. So as a volunteer, I'm more than happy to be here and be outside on a beautiful sunny Oklahoma day giving a tour. This is perfect.
Today, she's showing around an RV group traveling Route 66. Among them is Brenda Mabel. She appreciates learning Winchester's connection to the tragedy.
It means so much more just knowing that she had to go through this and live through her sister being lost and then helping raise her 3 nieces and watching them grow up without a mother. It's just, she makes it even more real.
For her part, Winchester says one of the lessons of the memorial is that political violence is never the answer. She wants to make sure tourists who come here during the shutdown still get that message.
If we have the opportunity to say, make a difference, be positive, do something for the good and the good of all. I mean, that's what it's about.
The museum next to the National Memorial also remains open. That's because the entire site is run by a nonprofit, which isn't funded by the government. For NPR News, I'm Abigail Sikowski in Oklahoma City.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:44. Coming up in just a moment, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. The Beltrami County History Center hosts a panel discussion on Saturday at 10 a.m. Designing the Future, Women in Engineering will highlight three women who are shaping the region's infrastructure and innovation. And you can take a walk on the Haunted Trail at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd, October 16th through the 18th, 7 to 9 each evening. Choose from low scare, high scare, or insane high scare options. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, Minnesota loses a longtime Twin Cities news anchor. Then, how is food insecurity affecting one of the state's most vulnerable resident groups? And youth leaders defend immigrant access to higher education. I'm Chantel Sings. Veteran Twin Cities journalist Stan Turner has died at age 81. Turner reported the news from KSTP-TV for 35 years and was known for his integrity, curiosity, and signature storytelling voice. A University of Minnesota journalism graduate, he was also honored with a degree in media law from William Mitchell School of Law. A Stan Turner Journalism Scholarship has been established at the University of Minnesota's Hubbard School of Journalism. Next, seniors in Minnesota living on fixed incomes are experiencing new levels of food insecurity. Britt Ahmed looks at two organizations that are trying to fill the gap for Minnesotans age 60+.
17% of Minnesota's households with at least one senior citizen are food insecure, according to Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank.
They're facing that even with programs we know that are targeted to meet the needs of seniors, like Meals on Wheels and Social Security, right?
Robin Manthe is Director of Neighbor Services for Second Harvest.
Many of them are working part-time jobs and doing everything they can to extend their income. But there is a point in your life where that isn't an option anymore. And my hope is they can reach out to us at Second Harvest. We have something called a care center where you can call us and we can help you understand your potential eligibility for two core programs.
One is the Commodity Supplemental Food Program, or CSFP,
which is a senior-focused food box with core items, grains, fruits, vegetables, protein, available on a monthly basis.
The other is SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
We can walk you through the eligibility criteria and the application.
Only 40% of eligible Minnesota seniors are enrolled in SNAP. Robin thinks that might be due to an incorrect notion that if they receive the benefit, they'll be taking it out of the mouths of those who need it more.
And actually, having people who are eligible and not participating in the program means we're leaving money on the table that could be coming into our state to support our economy, to invest in local grocery stores, to get more food getting grown locally by farmers. So we know that every dollar that someone gets in SNAP benefits creates $1.50 of economic benefit in the community.
Rising food costs on a limited budget means that some older Minnesotans are facing food insecurity for the first time as a senior.
When you only have this much money and everything starts costing more, suddenly that much money doesn't go as far.
Susie West is an educator at the University of Minnesota Extension, which, like Second Harvest, connects people to local food shelves.
SNAP, you have to apply, and it can take a while to get approved and get your benefits. Whereas food shelves, if you go to a food shelf, it's because you need food today.
Last year, state food shelves saw a record-breaking 9 million visits, per a report by the nonprofit Food Group.
It's not embarrassing to need help, and that there's literally hundreds of food shelves across Minnesota who would love for you to come in if you need food.
You can find out more at hungersolutions.org and 2, harvest.org. This is Britt Ahmet for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Immigrant youth leaders and the Minnesota Attorney General are speaking out against a U.S. Department of Justice lawsuit that could roll back the state's DREAM Act and North Star Promise program. At an event in Minneapolis, students and advocates shared how these programs made college affordable and urged the state to defend them. The Attorney General pledged to protest access to higher education, saying Minnesota should not lead with fear. The programs helped undocumented and low-income students pursue college and strengthen Minnesota's workforce.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Alyssa Nadworny. A change of location can offer a new chapter, or the illusion of one. In the new novel, The Four Spent the Day Together by Chris Krause, we meet the main character, Kat Green, as a child who's moved to a small Connecticut town, then again when she's an adult on the Minnesota Iron Range, and finally when she meets other people from that area whose lives are more precarious than her own. Addiction, art, and social class are all explored in this work of autofiction, part autobiography, part crime thriller. You may know her from her book I Love Dick or the TV show based on it. Chris Krause joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your stories contain a lot of true personal elements. So let's start with the protagonist, Kat Green. How much of her is you?
Well, she's my avatar. Kat Green is me at the moment of the story.
Does it happen in real time, or did you go in having a specific story to kind of dig up from your past?
Well, when I decided to write the novel, initially I thought I was going to just write about the crime. That was my first project, to write a true crime book about the incident on the Nagamok Trail on the Iron Range. But as I researched it, and I spent about 2.5 years researching it, really at the beginning of the research process, I realized two things. First, that I wasn't going to get enough interior material from all of the people involved to make the novel that I would ideally want to write. And second, I just sort of stumbled and started tripping back on my own past, because the town of Harding felt so similar. I felt this powerful deja vu to the little blue-collar town in Connecticut that my family had lived in while I was growing up.
Wow. Let's talk about place. The book is told in those three sections. In each new location, there's kind of this hope that the change of location is going to make life better. Can you talk a little bit about that illusion or desire?
On the Iron Range, researching the case, I talked to hundreds of people, probably more. And a phrase that came up over and over was, I moved here to make a fresh start. Over and over, people are making these fresh starts. And so I very consciously used that phrase multiple times in the book. There's something so poignant about it. It's so ill-fated from the start. But in the first part of the book, part one, it's about the lives of Kat's parents in the 1940s and 50s. They moved from the Bronx to Connecticut. There's this idea that it's going to be this huge improvement, this huge change of life. And just by saying Connecticut, they're going to, you know, it has this magical cachet that's going to be so elevating and life-changing. And of course, it wasn't at all. The commute was 4.5 hours for Jasper, the father, and Emma, the mother, who's really only ever known the Bronx, found it so incredibly lonely and alienating to be in a small white working class town where everybody went to grade school together and they have no desire to make any new friends.
Part three is mostly about a murder that takes place on the Iron Range. And you take the title from what I presume is the real news item on it, The Four Spent the Day Together?
The case was very well covered in the local newspapers. And it was in the reportage, I think, from Duluth, that I saw the phrase, the four spent the day together, as a way of recapping the events of the kidnapping and murder. And that struck me as so quaint. I grew up partly in New Zealand. My parents emigrated to New Zealand, and it seemed like a kind of phrase that I would have heard in New Zealand at the time of growing up. I mean, sort of a little kind of anachronistic British, almost 19th century, the four spent the day together, which is a very bizarre way to describe a kidnapping that takes place on methamphetamine.
Does that mean that there's kind of like duality in life, that there's harmony with tragedy, that there's like ordinary with extraordinary? Like, what does that say to you? What does that raise for you?
Well, I just thought it was a very funny turn of phrase. And it was the day rather than the murder that initially interested me in the crime. You know, there were a lot of murders up there. If it had just been bang, bang, you're dead in the living room or on the sidewalk, wouldn't have interested me so much. But the idea, the durational nature of it, and wondering what went on for the 16 or 18 hours that these people spent together, that was the mystery that I wanted to solve. And that wasn't a mystery that interested the police very much. I mean, of course, they're looking for a conviction. The police are working for the prosecution, and the prosecution are seeking a conviction. So they're only looking for the incidents, the material, the phrases that can lead to the conviction. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for everything else. You know, everything ambient, everything that kind of captures what the relationships were, what the vibe was between the kids, how the tempo of the day shifted. That was what I was interested in.
Yeah. Did you find the answers that you were looking for by writing this book?
No, nobody has the answers. I mean, the big question is, how did the murder change from a sort of mad idea that you have while you're high to a fait accompli over the course of the kidnapping? And there's no answer for that. Couldn't really locate it. There were multiple times when the victim could have left, but he didn't. They were all getting high together at multiple times in multiple locations. So, I mean, the conclusion is really that it was just became like a shared hallucination. And I think that's a very adolescent thing. I remember that from my own adolescence. I mean, maybe not to this degree and maybe not on as extreme drugs. Everything now is more brutal, more extreme. Everything is amplified. But the giddiness and the complicity and the collusion of being in this bubble of a little group, and you're doing everything together and you're kind of creating a group mind together, and it feels absolutely omnipotent. But the answer as to why did this happen, I don't see an answer for that. The guy who owned the rental property that the murder took place in, he deals a lot with these kids because he rents to them. And at one point we're talking and he said, the difference now is there's this depravity at the heart of everything, and I don't know where it comes from. I can't locate it, and I don't know how to stop it. So to me, that's the biggest unanswerable question.
Well, Chris Kraus, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Chris Kraus's new novel is The Four Spent the Day Together.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. There are many local stories to check out, and you can click the donate button to support independent community radio. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. 7 o'clock tonight, DJ Dang, your host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the 40s.